Hello and welcome to the BRC's latest Brexit podcast. I'm William Bain, BRC's Brexit Policy Advisor, and I'm joined, as ever, by my great colleague, Aidan Conley, Director of the NIRC. Hello, Aidan.
Hello, William. How's it going?
Very good. It's very wet at the time we're recording, but I suppose we're used to that in both islands.
It's God's tears because we're going through Brexit.
Okay, in this podcast we want to address the key question: is March going to be the crunch month for Brexit, or are we in for more can-kicking down the road? And this is a big week for the BRC and the NIRC because we are Brussels-bound to speak with the Article 50 Task Force. Really grateful that we can spend the time to speak with us and also to speak with key MEPs about the state of the Brexit process. There was another Brexit podcast. Yes, there are some out there for connoisseurs of the genre. And one of the things that, I'll say it was the RTE one, which Tony Connolly asked on that was, is Geoffrey Cox the man from Del Monte? Is he the man that will say yes on the backstop and on whether it's permanent or not, in terms of what's negotiated in Brussels? I suppose I remember growing up, various sort of law programs, LA law, maybe a bit of Callan as well, maybe a bit of Crown Court. So maybe it'll be a sort of daytime Crown Court drama when Geoffrey Cox makes that statement and we find out if he's changed his legal advice or not. So enough of all the legal puns. I think the key thing about what we're seeing between London and Brussels at the moment is, I think, some distance still about what the substance is, about any clarifications, reassurances, guidance which is given on the Irish Protocol, otherwise known as the backstop. And obviously one of the issues from the last Westminster vote in January on the deal itself is that for some MPs, not by all means all of those who voted against the deal, the issue about having reassurance about the backstop and it not being permanent in force forever is something that they were after. So that's one of the three strands that the Prime Minister's pursued through her interlocutor, Stephen Barclay, the Brexit Secretary, and now Geoffrey Cox being added to the team, the Attorney General, the man with the baritone voice, the UK government's top lawyer. And what we understand that they are trying to negotiate is not a expiry date to the backstop. It's not a unilateral withdrawal mechanism. It's possibly kind of two things, as we say, maybe some guarantees, some assurances, maybe turning those letters from Donald Tusk and Jean-Claude Juncker into some kind of legal form, so that MPs can see that the backstop is not intended to be permanent. I think if you look at the legal text, that's pretty much already there anyway. So I think that's one strand. The other strand we think they're looking at is the review mechanism itself. And we know that there is a sort of review process written into the backstop, which allows for either side every 6 months to say that the conditions for remaining in the backstop have been exceeded, and therefore alternative arrangements could take place at that point. So I think we might see a little bit just clarifying the review process, but what we're certainly not going to see is any of this talk that's been in the UK press over the weekend about an arbitration mechanism that's separate and cuts across the role of the European Court of Justice. That's just not on from a Brussels point of view. So I think that sort of idea really would have to be dropped. But we are in sweaty palm time. I think all of our members, all of the wider business community, really concerned these big, big votes probably coming next week. And I think every time you talk to people in the business world, they're doing what they can, but they're really worried about the consequences of a no-deal Brexit. Is that what you're finding, Aidan, over in Northern Ireland too?
Absolutely, and I think it might be useful at this stage to sort of give a wee bit of the political context on this. So firstly, and overarching is the fact that we don't have that deal through yet. And all the good intentions in the world only pave the way to hell. However, there's a good feeling that, you know, things are slightly closer. But what the EU need to do and what Geoffrey Cox needs to provide is a ledge for the DUP, for example, to stand on, to allow them to sort of roll back that they have accomplished something. But it's not just them. There's some of the people that are being targeted at the minute as far as Scottish Lib Dems, as far as Conservative Party members who are not English nationalists. Your IDSs and your John Redwoods are simply not going to vote for any deal that comes along. So it's who are the people that could actually change their mind and how to give them the confidence. And similarly, there are people, for example, Labour MPs in northern constituencies who realise that they're in Leave constituencies, but they want the best for the future for those constituencies and realise that a deal, and this deal, might be the best way to do it. So the political context is that, quite simply, there's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of persuasion to be done. I think the DUP, though, will be key in this, because if they move, then a lot of people, you're talking maybe about 30 to 40 MPs, will move along with them, because they have had the same sort of constitutional concerns that the DUP has had. Honestly, though, it's a lot of work to do in a short amount of time. And we do know that one of the big failures of this whole process is the inability to take people, including MPs, on this sort of journey. So what we're going to see over this next few weeks might be a rowing back on the sort of vitriol and putting people back in their place, as we've seen in the press over this past few months, and a more conciliatory, giving people that ledge to stand on so the greater good can prevail of getting a deal across the line.
Wow, it's going to have to be a big ledge. It might turn into a balcony. You know, we're going to have the DUP, a lot of the ERG on it, you know, good number of Labour MPs as well. My goodness, it's going to be a congested balcony, all right.
And I said it was never going to be easy.
Yes. And I think that does show that to get to 320 votes, a working majority vote in the House of Commons, really you need to put those different disparate groups together. You know, those who are worried about the backstop, that's the DUP, some of those in the European Research Group of Conservative MPs, the kind of ultra hard Brexit supporting MPs. And then you've also got Labour MPs as well. And as we've seen, the Prime Minister has been conjuring up money from interesting sources to potentially give to areas over a number of years which you know, need some regeneration, which perhaps feel that they weren't given enough attention over various governments. But we've seen today that that's not maybe having the desired effect in terms of winning over some of those Labour MPs and Leave constituencies. That,
well, between that and the extra 140 million that was announced in the Northern Ireland budget last week, one might think that there may be something else other than patriarchal altruism at work here.
Well, I'll pass on that, because of course I used to be involved in elected politics, and I can say that's absolutely always just altruism that's the key thing in voting on policy issues. Absolutely, always the case. So I think it's this piecing together of this Commons majority. And I think what we can look at is probably there's a kind of spectrum of outcomes still possible on meaningful vote two, which may be on or maybe just before March the 12th. That would be either, you know, sneaking over the line, getting to 320, seeing a Commons majority in favour of the deal, anywhere from that to losing probably by about 100. And I think at this point, nobody knows, certainly the Prime Minister doesn't know, the Chief Whip, nobody quite where on that spectrum it's going to be. And it really is going to depend on what a few dozen MPs decide to do, what their view is about the backstop, what their view is about Geoffrey Cox's legal advice, depending on what comes back from Brussels. And at this stage, it's still very, very hard to call what's going to be a dramatic week next week. I think useful just to set out the process. So a meaningful vote is expected by or on March the 12th. If that is approved, then the next stage is that the withdrawal agreement bill would be brought by the government to Parliament. Now, we reckon that would probably take about a couple of months to pass. It's got to get through both chambers. Really important bill, citizens' rights, the transition itself, and the financial settlement, three big things. And, of course, it's going to legislate a fourth big thing for the backstop itself. So that's going to be a really important bill. Expect full scrutiny in the Commons and Lords on that. And I think that really is taking us beyond that possibility of March the 29th. I mean, I suppose it is still theoretically possible if it's done really quickly. But for a bill of that importance, and with bits of the trade bill still needing to be passed as well, it is already beginning to look more likely that it's going to go beyond March the 29th, and that the PM, even if the deal is passed, might have to apply for a technical extension of a couple of months in order to get that legislation through and deliver an orderly Brexit if that's what the Commons votes for on March the 12th. What are the other possibilities? Well, on March the 12th, MPs could tough out the deal once again, vote it down. Then we're into a series of votes at Westminster if that occurs. So the next day, the 13th, Parliament would be asked to say whether it approves of exiting without a deal or not. I think all the evidence is that MPs, the majority of MPs, would be against that no-deal scenario. It's what we got from the Spelman Amendment vote a few weeks ago. And then if that vote is passed, what would happen is that it goes to another vote on the 14th, and that's whether MPs would want to see an extension of the Article 50 process. Now, the PM said that MPs would have a say on how long the extension could be, so that could be an amendable motion. They could maybe talk about 2 or 3 months. Some MPs might recommend a longer period for the extension. But the important thing to remember is that that is only a request by Parliament. Parliament cannot dictate how long the extension would be, because under the treaty, Prime Minister would take that request to Brussels, ask for that at the European Council, but the European Council, acting unanimously, could set a longer or a shorter extension. It could impose conditions or terms to that extension. So it's really the European Council that has most of the power in this process.
And that's a fundamental point, William. And the fact that the European Council is very disparate heads of countries rather than being the bureaucrats or the officials from the EU, from the Commission, that will want to move things on. Once it gets to that European Council, there are politics at play.
Absolutely. And the next stage that would happen if there were an extension approved by the European Council is it would have to come back to the House of Commons the following week. You know, this is real nail-biting time. We're days to go until the legal exit day as things stand. And MPs would have to vote on a delegated piece of legislation brought by the government to change the exit date in law. That would be a very interesting vote indeed. I mean, just imagine the scenario if MPs have voted for a transition of a certain period and the PM comes back with a transition and with an extension period of a different length and with different conditions. How would that vote go with just days, literally talking about 72, 96 hours to go until Brexit happens itself? The pace of events is really going to pick up indeed over the next few weeks. I think some other important aspects as to why March might not be the crunch month, might be one of the crunch months, but we could have many crunch months ahead, is that even in terms of a no-deal outcome, so even if that emerged as what MPs wanted on the 13th of March, or if it was agreed between both sides in some other way, if you look at the legislation that have to go through between now and no deal exit day, you know, around 6 bills, hundreds of statutory instruments, setting rules on everything from food to data. Again, it doesn't look likely that all of that is going to get through until March the 29th. So you could have, even in a no-deal scenario, the UK Prime Minister submitting a request to the European Council to essentially have a sort of period to allow for no deal to be done in the least harmful way possible. So I think on all Brexit scenarios, although we know what the law says, which is still 29th of March is exit day, I think a lot of the underlying factors would lead us to believe that March, it's a crunch month, but it might not be the crunch month in terms of the Brexit process. So, Aidan, one of the key things that's also coming up is some talk around future trade deals. Obviously, a lot of talk in the last few days over a possible trade deal with America, what that might mean for tariffs and for food standards. But also there's this issue about the trade deals that haven't been rolled over. If you think about Liam Fox got a rough time on the Mar show on Sunday. And this issue about trade deals is really important for businesses in Great Britain and Northern Ireland as well, isn't it?
It's hugely important. At the end of the day, it's not just about the food that we buy. So we buy about 2.4 billion of Northern Ireland agri food, but 60% of that goes through the Republic of Ireland to get to GB, where our consumers and our shoppers use it. We'll need to have that trade deal with the EU, even just to get our goods through there. But as well as that, while Liam Fox is talking about all these wonderful trade deals that are going to roll over, all these new trade deals, we have to remember that 70% of the food that we get into this country from the rest of the world, from outside of the EU, it's already at zero tariffs, or it's at vastly preferential tariffs. And the reason being that we're members of the EU. So it's not just that we're at a low starting point. We actually have to work very hard to get in such a good position as we are now before we see any of these benefits. The other side of things is, you know, we have to agree with the Brexiteers in some way that we will be able to do lots of new trade deals. That's wonderful. However, the thing is, the average time to do a trade deal is 4.5 years. Now, our consumers in Northern Ireland are particularly bad. We've half of the discretionary income of households in Great Britain. But quite simply, households across Great Britain can't afford to have that sort of fiscal chaos and cost rises for 4 months, never mind the 4.5 years that it takes to get the average trade deal.
Absolutely, and some of the key deals that retail really depends upon are, of course, that deal with Turkey. Lots of retailers import clothes from Turkey at zero tariff. That's not rolled over and doesn't look any way it will be by Brexit Day, whenever that is. That's an increase in tariff of 12% that'll feed through into higher cost pressures. Again, we know about the deal with Japan not being ready as well. That's going to be a big issue for other industries. But a whole range from countries like Mexico, we import a lot of soft fruit and berries from Mexico, and that one not being ready will impact on supply and cost of goods for consumers as well. So this has been
I think what you said there, William, was hugely important about the clothes from Turkey. We have done a lot of talk about groceries at the minute, but we have to remember that the effects of a no-deal Brexit will be death by a thousand cuts, to use the Chinese comparison, on the consumer. It's not just the food that you put on the table. It's the clothes on your back. It's your fuel. Your car insurance could go up, or will go up as well. It's your white goods. It's your carpets. It's your cars themselves. This is where the real problem is, that it's not just one thing, but it is cost rises that will come across the board, where anything that we get from the EU or from the rest of the world that isn't covered by a trade deal will invariably go up because of tariffs, because of customs, and because of non-tariff barriers.
Yep, that's very much the case. Well, I think that's all from this edition of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed our sort of legal thoughts. If you can come up with any other suitably legal descriptions for Geoffrey Cox, we'd be delighted to hear from you on those. And we look forward to speaking to you on the next edition, when we will, of course, have had all the latest insight from Brussels. So it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Bye.